I'd like to welcome you all to this panel presentation and discussion on Europe, Farewell to an Idea. Note that it's a question and not a statement. My name is Peter McPhee. I'm a Provost of the University of Melbourne. Delighted to welcome you all to this session and particularly to our alumni. Just a reminder that the entire session is being filmed and audio recorded. Ask you then, therefore, to be very sure that your mobile phones are off. What we're planning to do is to have three brief presentations from our panel. Then there'll be a short interchange between them, a moderated discussion, and then we intend, of course, to throw it open to you for your comments and questions. Among the key questions and the key themes that we hope we'll address in this session are the following. Can the European Union act as a counterweight between East and West, between US dominance on one side, the emergence of new superpowers like China and India, and the re-emergence of Russia as a superpower? Secondly, in an economically stressed Europe, is there inevitably a return to a preoccupation with national interests? And in particular, what might that mean for European-wide policies that have to do with climate change? A third theme, obviously in the aftermath of World War II, one of the ideas motivating Europe, one of the great ideas was the idea that in future conflicts between peoples and between nation states could be moderated in a more civilised, in inverted commas, way. Is that still true? Fourth, a fortnight ago, Europe went to the polls and people were dispirited by the low turnout, as low as 45% across the 27 member states. In fact, in some of the newer member states like Slovakia and Lithuania, only one in five voted. In many parts of Western Europe, political parties most committed to the idea of Europe were those which suffered most. So to outline their views on these and other key questions, we have three expert and distinguished presenters. I'm going to deliberately introduce them very briefly because you have biographical notes on them and we want to leave as much time to hear from them rather than from me. To begin with, let me introduce His Excellency David Daly. David is the recently appointed Head of Delegation, Ambassador of the European Commission Delegation to Australia. Between 2005 and 2008, he was Head of Unit for Croatia, responsible for negotiations over Croatia's accession. In a very distinguished career, he's also been involved with agreements ranging from textiles to agriculture. David was educated at Dublin University and University College Dublin, and we're delighted that he's agreed to be part of our panel today. Thank you, David.
Peter, thank you very much for that introduction, and thank you very much for the opportunity to speak on this topic, Europe, Farewell to an Idea. And I'm extremely grateful that the question mark is included in the topic. If you'll allow, I'd like to start by throwing out some ideas about ideas, as this is a festival of ideas, and I would like to congratulate Melbourne, the University of Melbourne, for having the idea of a festival of ideas. Ideas matter. As the British journalist and historian Tony Judt has recently written of today's world, if we are to understand the world whence we have just emerged, we need to remind ourselves of the power of ideas. I'd like to offer two quotes about ideas, which I find particularly appropriate as regards the European Union. An idea is salvation by imagination. Frank Lloyd Wright. We must not forget that the EU was born out of war to prevent war in the future, such as Europe had seen every 50 years stretching back through the centuries. After World War II, we needed men of new ideas, of imagination, and of political courage to come to our salvation. Men such as Robert Schuman and plenty others. Second quote, I can't understand why people are afraid of new ideas. I'm afraid of the old ones. John Cage. if ever frustrated with one aspect of the EU or another, we should remind ourselves that we have tried the alternative, and it doesn't work. Centuries of bloody history in Europe have shown that. Again, thankfully, after World War II, there were people in Europe who felt the need for new ideas and who wanted to leave behind the old ones. A word of caution. The EU is work in progress, and every generation must make its investment in the European project. As President of the Commission, President Barroso, said only last week, this is not the time for complacency. Well, it never is. One can debate the issue as to whether there's only one singular idea of Europe, or the European project, whatever you want to call it. If the EU is work in progress, is there a clear single version or vision of the final destination of the EU? No. There are at least 27 different official ideas, and possibly even 500 million other ideas. This is not only an interesting academic issue to ponder, but it has also important political implications. At every stage of the European integration process, there is a natural balancing act which must be achieved between these differing visions of the single idea of Europe or the final destination of Europe. This natural balancing act explains the compromises which allow all member states to agree whatever can be agreed at that particular point in time. Notwithstanding this last point, I would nonetheless like to show that the idea of Europe is alive and well, and among other ways, this can be seen through the many ways in which other countries, including Australia, bump into the EU on the world stage. In today's world, countries such as Australia find themselves bumping into the EU in various ways, possibly to the surprise of some people. I would like to examine briefly why this is so. Is it, for example, because of some devious political master plan on the part of the EU seeking world domination? No. Short answer, but complete. No. I would suggest that the EU's increasing role in the world stems from a combination of its expansion in terms of policies and membership. Over time, the EU has developed policies which bring it onto the world stage. Over time, new members have increased the size and economic importance of the EU and have created new next-door neighbours for the EU. Before going any further, I would like to clarify something. I use the term bumping into the EU with the emphasis on the into, as in, I bumped into a friend while shopping in Bourke Street the other day. I do not use the term bumping off the EU, as in hitting off something akin to an obstacle. The EU is founded on the values of respect for human dignity, freedom, democracy, equality, the rule of law, respect for human rights. These values underpin pluralism, non-discrimination, tolerance, justice, and solidarity. In its relations with the wider world, the EU tries to uphold and promote these values. I'd like to examine three external policies of the EU and look at their impact on what we're doing in the world and what we're doing with Australia. These are our trade policy, development policy, and what you could call classical foreign policy. Firstly, on trade policy. Since the achievement of the customs union in 1968, we've had an external trade policy common to all member states. Because trade is dealt with at the EU level, it means that other trading partners have to negotiate with the EU directly, in fact, with the European Commission representing the member states for this purpose. This is keenly felt at the international trade talks at the World Trade Organization in Geneva, where the EU is a big player. Today, as you know, the hot topic is the conclusion of the Doha round of trade talks. It's felt that 80% of the hard work has already been done and that the round needs just another injection of political will to be achieved. The prize is big, more than $150 billion injection into the world economy at a time when it is most needed. A halving of all customs duties currently collected worldwide and as an insurance against resurgent protectionism. This is an area where Australia, like others, bumps into the EU. However, the key thing to note is that the EU and Australia are now basically on the same side of this debate, despite our differences. We both want a Doha deal. Neither of us will be found wanting whenever we enter the critical last 10 minutes of those negotiations. Development aid policy. It grew out of concern by member states for their former colonies. Today, there are 77 countries from Africa, the Caribbean, and the Pacific covered by the latest agreement, the Cotonou Partnership Agreement. This agreement combines political dialogue with aid for a host of activities ranging from strengthening good governance, human rights and the rule of law, to economic capacity building and poverty reduction. Today, the European Union, together with its member states, is the world's largest donor of development assistance worldwide, amounting to some €46 billion a year. This represents around 60% of all development aid given globally. The world is a big place, and developmental needs are huge. So how come Australia bumps into the EU in this context? Well, in two respects. Firstly, we bump into each other at the OECD, which has a coordinating role for developed countries in respect of their development aid, and where there is a constant push for using our money more effectively. Secondly, we bump into each other in the Pacific, where Australia is the biggest donor to that region, and the EU is the second biggest, with €450 million allocated for the next period. We are actively engaged together in coordinating our assistance to these countries, in seeing if we could deliver the aid more efficiently together, in opening up our aid schemes to each other, something we are starting with a number of programs in certain Asian countries. I now turn to the third of these external policies of the EU, what you could call classical foreign policy. Well, this is another area where we bump into each other. Maybe that this comes as a surprise to some of you, because you may well ask, you know, does the EU have a foreign policy? Actually, I think the better question to ask is, what type of foreign policy does the EU have? Here, the short answer is an evolving one. This is not surprising, given the importance of foreign policy to all countries everywhere. At the same time, there is a realization that the EU is strong when it speaks with one voice. Today, that means unanimity on the EU side of the table on these foreign policy issues. There's also the realization that the EU has a certain responsibility as an important actor globally, and that it should shoulder this responsibility. Back in the 70s, already there were attempts at better coordination of positions on foreign policy issues between the member states, the so-called European political cooperation. But The fall of the Berlin Wall and the disintegration of Yugoslavia led to a much stronger degree of cooperation with the creation of the Common Foreign and Security Policy in 1992. The experience of the Balkan Wars led to a renewed political push at giving the EU a stronger instrument for the conduct of foreign policy, namely the European Security and Defence Policy, adopted in 1999. The EU gave itself its first European Security Strategy in 2003 and reviewed it last December. This plotted the new security threats facing Europe. The nature of the security threat was changing away from that of territorial defence against external aggression. Instead, security threats are being posed from non-state actors, from increasing radicalism and terrorism, from social and political disruption stemming from climate change and other issues. The instruments to tackle these new security threats need to combine both hard and soft tools, with emphasis on strengthening weak states and helping them to develop. Now, where did all of this lead? Today, the EU has shown itself much more of a player than before, in contrast to the way it had handled the Balkan Wars of the 1990s. The EU speaks more clearly through Dr. Solana, the High Representative for CFSP, Common Foreign and Security Policy issues, in coordination with the European Commissioner for External Affairs, Madame Ferraro-Waldner. The EU played an important role in stopping conflict in the Balkans, in the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia. The EU has become more of a player than before in the Middle East. Dr. Solana has played a certain role in talks with Iran on nuclear issues. Last year, the EU played a crucial role in negotiating the ceasefire in Georgia. This was backed up by a quick deployment of monitors who were important in getting Russian troops to withdraw. A special representative of Dr. Solana is co-chairing talks between the parties in Geneva. Also last year, the EU launched its first naval mission to address the issue of piracy off the coast of Somalia. Again last year, the EU deployed a military force to Chad to help protect refugees from Darfur. This was a holding exercise, bringing protection to those refugees long before the UN force could replace the EU force. So the EU can be pleased with the progress it has made in terms of foreign policy. However, we should remain balanced in our appraisal. We should reject either extreme pessimism, that the EU will never have a real foreign policy and it should stop trying to have one, or extreme optimism, that we have today a foreign policy capability the same as any country. The EU has made important progress, but there is still much to be done, and the Lisbon Treaty would bring further improvements in terms of streamlined instruments. Now, what does any of this have to do with Australia, you might ask? Well, the EU and Australia cooperate on a number of issues in this context. We work together on counter-terrorism issues through the Joint Centre for Law Enforcement in Jakarta. We follow the situation in Fiji with equal concern. We're like-minded on many issues at the UN. We share the same basic outlook on the situation in Afghanistan, where Australia has troops and where 22 EU member states, between them, have 27,000 troops, and where the EU has a significant aid programme. And the total European bill for this is in the region of 8 billion euros. I've mentioned the three main external relations policies of the European Union as examples of how you can bump into us on the world stage. You can also bump into the internal EU policies at a global level. Some internal policies have always had important external elements affecting countries outside the EU. Now, I do not have time at this stage to go into details, but it is clear that internal policies such as EMU, Economic and Monetary Union, the Euro, such as environmental policy, climate change, agriculture policy, even higher education policy, each has implications for countries outside the EU. But I think Peter would be dragging me off with a crook were I to go into detail on each of those. I'll turn very briefly to make three points in relation to the enlargement of the European Union as a pole of attraction, as a question of size, and as a question of having new next-door neighbours. The EU has attracted new member states since the beginning. Successive enlargements have increased the size from 6 to 9, 10, 12, 15, 25, and now to 27. These accessions have been driven by political reasons, with countries wanting to benefit from this democratic club. Also, there are economic reasons related to the single European market, which today boasts 500 million consumers. The recent enlargement was the biggest and most complicated, especially taking in the countries of the former Eastern Bloc. Nonetheless, it was an historic opportunity which Europe was not going to miss. The attraction of joining the EU continues, as demonstrated by the current candidate countries. There is no sense that the idea of Europe is waning among the candidate countries or potential candidate countries. EU enlargement has increased the size of the single market to 500 million consumers. The EU's internal regulations and standards, therefore, matter hugely to all who wish to export to this market. EU standards influence global standards more today than ever before. This matters also for Australia. The EU is still the most important economic partner for Australia in terms of trade and investment. EU investment here, or the investment of European companies here, represents over a third of all foreign investment. European companies here account for 1.2 million Australian jobs. One operational conclusion I would draw would be that Australian exporters should pay more attention to discussions in Brussels before regulations are adopted, when there are more opportunities to shape them. Another obvious implication of enlargement is that the EU gets, literally, new next-door neighbours. At the same time, the EU acquires new colleagues around the council table in Brussels who have themselves their own particular experience of dealing with those new next-door neighbours. Examples would be Russia or Ukraine, and there are others. Leslie will speak in more detail on some of them. You will be delighted, Peter, to hear that I will very soon take the advice of my compatriot, Oscar Wilde, who said, "Some people cause happiness wherever they go, others whenever they go." I am drawing to a close. Just a few conclusions. In today's world, we all face major challenges. The global financial crisis, securing further international trade liberalization, climate change, international security, counterterrorism, and so on. These global challenges cannot be satisfactorily addressed by single countries acting purely on their own. We all need each other. Because of our high degree of like-mindedness, Australia and the EU are natural partners for each other. We are already working closely together on these issues. As we have seen, much work over many years has gone into making the EU what it is today. This work is not finished. We've looked at certain EU policies of particular interest to our international partners. We did not stumble upon these policies ready-made. They have been laboured over. Negotiations continued until compromises were agreed. Why? Why bother? Because 6, 9, 10, 12, 15, 25, 27 countries in Europe wanted these policies. Why did they want them? Because these policies represent parts of the idea of Europe which everybody could agree on at particular moments in time. And now I would like to close with reference to two further quotations. "An invasion of armies can be resisted, but not an idea whose time has come, Victor Hugo. And man's mind, once stretched by a new idea, never regains its original dimensions, Oliver Wendell Holmes. The idea of Europe, whatever that is certainly an idea whose time has come. The mind of Europe, now having taken on board this idea for over 50 years, will not easily regain its original dimensions. Thank you very much for your attention.
David, thank you very much for that elegant statement of the idea and the actuality, the promise of Europe. Our next presenter is Associate Professor Philomena Murray. Philomena is Associate Professor in the School of Social and Political Sciences and Director of the Contemporary Europe Research Centre here at the University of Melbourne. She holds Australia's only personal Jean Monnet Chair awarded by the European Union. She's a former diplomat herself and runs training courses on negotiating with the EU for the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade in Canberra. She recently received a national citation for outstanding contributions to student learning for pioneering the first European Union curriculum in Australia. Philo, we're very pleased that you've agreed to present to us today. Thank you.
Thank you. It's an absolute pleasure to be here. I'd like to thank Patrick for inviting me. I'm delighted to see some old faces, old as in familiar, not as in ancient. Belgium. And I think that that's been one of our challenges, that here in Australia we tend to see the European Union very much in terms of its trade protectionism. I would suggest to you that there's a lot more going on. And one of the ways in which we can understand the idea of Europe, or indeed the ideas of Europe, is the way that the European Union began as a means of presenting hope. As you can see, this is people sitting in front of some really nice flowers. The person who has the hat, works, is, does anyone know who it is? Winston Churchill. Does anyone know who this is? Jean Monnet, that's right, or Jean Monnet, as I get told regularly. I'm often introduced as the Jean Monnet chair. So I'd like to basically let you know that there were a lot of ideas around at the time, but also based on diversity. And in fact, unity and diversity is the basis of the European Union's, it's actually its motto. On my PhD, which is from the European University Institute, it actually has unity and diversity written on the PhD certificate, which is beautiful because the Italians designed it and looks absolutely gorgeous. And the whole idea is that we should have unity in diversity. So we're looking, basically what we see is that the idea of the European Union as a symbol, in a sense, of hope, a symbol of being able to actually bring something different to the world, as David has talked about. Now, so I would like to suggest to you that diversity is actually something we should value in the European Union, and we should also challenge in the European Union, because I think that it's not necessarily doing a good job in terms of dealing with the many diversities within its own ranks. And I would suggest to you that the constant conflict between nationalism and Europeanism, or nationalism and supranationalism, to use the jargon of the day, is actually a good tension. I think it's an uneasy tension, and I think that's what actually makes the European Union work. So when these people got together in the Hague Congress in 1948, what they were trying to do was to bring about a new sense of reconciliation, and decided to create new ideas based on the norms of good governance, on the norms of human rights, for example. They said, never again must we have human rights abuses. And the first organization was actually the Council of Europe, which was based, which created the European Court for Human Rights, for example. Now, so the peace imperative is terribly important. As you can see, Ambrose Bierce is always very useful. He actually died the year of the First World War. And just for those of you who can't see the PowerPoint, which is really just my colleagues here on my right, war is God's way of teaching Americans geography. I think that comment could just as easily be made today. And I would suggest to you that many would see Europe as God's way of teaching the world about peace. And that is one of the challenges, that not everyone wants to accept that. And the European Union spread of ideas is not universally welcomed. It is not universally appreciated. And here in Australia, and indeed in the broader Asia-Pacific context, that is the case. In fact, that sometimes one gets the impression with the European Union that it is presenting one union to bind them all, to misquote from Lord of the Rings. And I would suggest to you that not everyone sees the European Union as my precious, but rather that there is quite a lot of opposition, and there, some of the problems are with the rhetorical overload that you see in the way the European Union presents its norms, not with the way the norms have actually developed within the EU itself. But its public persona, its political persona as it exports it, is one that I think is very, very problematic. And so you have many comments about how the European Union must teach the rest of the world in ASEAN, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, or in Mercosur, the Common Market of the South, in South America, for example. And when I was interviewing people in the European Commission, and I hope they still will allow me to do so after I've said all this, David, this is a direct quote from somebody I interviewed, and she said, people in the Commission are integration snobs in the sense that we've done something, and because it worked successfully, we sort of think we know it all. And she said, I think we come across as being arrogant sometimes. And I think this integration snobbery has not helped the European Union's cause, even when it is doing a lot of very good things. And indeed, Vera Waldner, Mrs. Vera Waldner, the European Commission commissioner responsible for external relations, actually David's boss, she actually has said things like, we must make the rest of the world learn from our experience. And I just worry about that sort of language. In the interviews that I carried out, people said, yes, we think we are a very value-driven global actor. And the European Union very self-consciously has established itself as what it calls inevitably a global actor. There are some challenges there, and quite rightly David has pointed out those challenges. And it is not a fully formed foreign policy as we would like to neatly categorise in the nation state context, because it consists of 27 nation states who have been transformed, and the transformative nature of the European Union is very important. But in another quote, one of the people I interviewed in the European Commission, I asked them to describe what you think is your role, and they said the EU's international ambitions are always going to be very value-driven. But I love the next one, and I said to the person, do you realise I am going to quote you? He said, the EU has global ambitions in terms of dousing civil wars wherever possible, in terms of pointing the world, steering the world, dragging the world in the righteous path on climate change and biodiversity. That comment scares the hell out of me. I don't want the European Union, which has achieved so much, to be dragging the world anywhere. I think that it should not indeed be steering the world. And this idea of pointing the world in the right direction, I think, is very problematic in terms of setting the European Union up as a paradigm of good governance, which some of us may doubt, I know, after the European Parliament elections, which people went to the trouble of not going to vote about, 43%. So what I worry about is that there are these fantastic ideals in the European Union. It has a fantastic vision, but its public relations is difficult. But I would suggest to you that how it actually projects its international persona on the world stage is a problem. And that is not to undermine all the good things that it has done. Now, for inspiration, I went to a local author, Elliot Perlman, whose book, $3, is definitely worth a read. I actually didn't go to it for inspiration for this talk. I was at home quarantined because my son had perhaps not got swine flu. What Elliot Perlman has said, if we can all agree through ASEAN, APEC, NAFTA, the European Community, meaning the European Union as it is now, GATT, the WTO and the IMF, to knock off work early and be with our children, he said, no one in the world would have a competitive advantage. I thought I'd use that quote to actually suggest to you that the idea of a social Europe is something that's very important for the European Union. And again, it's very much part of what they call the social model, which is being exported to a certain extent as an ideal in other parts of the world, not least in relations with the Association of Southeast Nations and some of its other partners. So I would suggest to you that we've got to be a little bit careful about this lack of comprehension about how this, even these good social models are actually accepted in other parts of the world. For instance, the European Union is the only regional bloc in the world which has a policy known as cohesion, that is, giving aid to less advantaged regions, to deindustrialized zones, to the long-term unemployed, to women returning to the workforce, to people who need vocational education and training and skills, the acquiring of new skills, for instance. It's the only international organization and set of institutions in the world which actually takes money from one country and gives it to another. Or as one German parliamentarian called it, the cohesion policy is all about putting your hands in other people's pockets, not your own, and he knew because the Germans mostly pay for it. And so this whole idea of social Europe is very important, and Jeremy Rifkin in his book, The European Dream, written by an American about how the United States should be more like Europe, has actually used this as an example. So has Mark Leonard in his very provocative book, Why Europe Will Run the 21st Century. Great book, by the way. A very interesting, very controversial. And so this idea of its social values and social norms, which the European Union advances, is, I think, very important. So I would suggest to you that we have some problems in terms of the understanding the transformative nature of the European Union, but I think it also has some problems in understanding how it exports its own norms. It is a regulatory body. It has regulations which have impact on us here in Australia, which is why we have signed a mutual recognition agreement between the Australian government and the European Union, for example. But one of the challenges in the EU's extension of its norms and promotions of its norms is the fact that it actually not only seems to be deregulating and then regulating, but for many people in the Anglo-Saxon influenced world, it also seems to be pre-regulating. It's the idea that they'll do this, just in case you were thinking of doing, don't do it because we've just actually made a law on it. That's sort of more Napoleonic continental European idea. Or as I discovered when I lived in Italy, there used to be signs in the old trains in Italy which said, non sputare dalla finestra, which said, don't spit out the window. I never thought of spitting out the window till I saw a sign telling me not to. And it's that sense of pre-regulatory normative drive which you see in some aspects of the European Union, however they are trying to curtail it, which actually makes people quite concerned about the European Union itself and how it exports itself, its norms to other parts of the world. Now, you may recognise the person on the left, a guy called John Howard. Some of you may remember him vaguely from the past when he used to be important. And he actually has very much... was very much aware of the role of memory and the burden of memory in the European-Australia relationship. But he did agree to meet with Romano Prodi, the person in the middle, who when he was then a president of the European Commission, and Chris Patten, who looks distinctly uncomfortable, the then European Commissioner for External Relations. What happens in the relationship is that the relationship is developed from what I call the Kapuk factor. You know the CAPUC factor? It stands for the Common Agricultural Policy and the UK. And that they are the two focuses of the Australian relationship with the European Union over about 40 years. The idea that the European Union is a protectionist bloc on agriculture and therefore we won't work with it. In fact, the European Union is Australia's largest partner. And there has been the signing of a major agreement, which David talked about. Look, doesn't it look great with the flags and everything? And so this major agreement sees, in fact, a change where... just lost my little pointer, where it is moving to a new direction. Sorry, just, there it is. It's so neat and compact. And so the new direction is this direction, where a certain Kevin Rudd is meeting and talking about the way forward. So the way forward in many ways is to move beyond the obsession with agriculture, and especially now that Australia actually exports three times as much agricultural produce to the European Union than the other way around. Fascinating. And the second issue is that the UK is not the only member state of the European Union with whom Australia has a relationship, and there is an increasing recognition that it has 27 countries, but those 27 countries come together in decision making in Brussels, where they meet very regularly. So I'm suggesting then that really, in a sense, the European Union has to decide whether it wants to keep its deep values and its norms. And that's Jean Monnet on the left, and the little guy there is Sarkozy. I didn't actually make it small. It's actually him at a conference where Jean Monnet was a big backdrop, and I just loved that photo. It's actually on the European Union website. So I think that what we're looking at in the Monnet idea, or Jean Monnet, as he's affectionately known, and the idea of Europe of culture, of sharing of values, a Europe of culture, of civilian power, a Europe of normative power as well, a Europe which sees itself as smart power in bringing together particularly cultural and educational cooperation, as well as what the, its involvement in civilian and military operations and conflict transformation and conflict resolution, or the guy on the right, Carla was obviously away, and what you see is you've got Nicolas here, who basically wants to, a certain return to nationalism and to protectionism, and he and Angela Merkel wrote, the Chancellor of Germany, wrote a joint article just before the European elections saying, we want you to vote. It was such a dull article. I felt so uninspired reading it. It didn't make me want to vote at all. But the value is in what one person has termed, in a terrible abuse of the English language, the banalization of Franco-German relations, the rendering banal of the relationship between the French and the Germans, that they can actually have a joint letter urging people to vote for the European Parliament elections. And that, I think, is its value, rather than the fact that it was, you know, Europe is our future, we sort of think, but we're not too sure, so we're going to give you a long list of all the challenges that we're facing. Not the greatest bit of writing I've seen, but I think that nevertheless the message is important. So what does the future hold? I would suggest that the European Union is under tremendous pressure to continue its absolutely admirable efforts to ensure that there is no return to internecine strife, to the nationalist hatred of the past. If I get interviewed one more time by a journalist, including this morning, saying, is the EU finished? Is it over? Well, the European Union is not over. Whether we like it or not, it is here to stay. It is in crisis. 112 million hits on Google was the last that I counted a few days ago when I typed in Europe in crisis. So I thought, I'll try crisis in Europe, 112 million there as well. E pur si muove, as Galileo would say. And yet it works, and yet it moves. It does work, it is here to stay, and we in Australia, and those of us involved in the understanding and projection and expansion of ideas, would like to think that we need to understand it. The spectre of war may not be the sort of world war context of the past, but nevertheless, we have seen with the European Parliament elections that extremism and exclusionism and anti-Semitism and anti-Muslim sentiment and the lack of a policy which is at the moment coherent enough to deal with exclusionism and to deal with ethnic minorities and religious minorities in particular, with Islam as the most the fastest growing religion within the European Union, that is a challenge that it faces, and it is a huge challenge. So the European Union sees itself very much in terms of looking at its unity and diversity within its own structures, but also it is not the only soft power around. The United States is the other soft power. Whether Russia will ever come to be a soft power, I'm not too sure, but certainly it sees itself very much as a hard power. A joke doing the rounds in some European intellectual circles is of President Obama, President Sarkozy, and President Dmitry Medvedev of Russia standing on a beach, and they see this island, and Barack Obama says, let's go over to the island. And so he walks on water over to the island. And then Sarkozy says, oh, Barack, I will follow you. So he goes after him and he walks over on water. And poor Dmitry gets into the water, sinks. Okay. So what happens? Nicolas Sarkozy turns to Barack and says, should we tell Dmitry about the underwater steps? And he said, what steps? Because for the Europeans, Obama does walk on water for the Europeans. Okay, so the European Union is a soft power, but then so too is the United States. And one way of describing this soft power is that the European Union speaks softly and carries a big carrot. And that is that, and that's a description made by a former advisor to Blair, Robert Cooper. And he talks about this whole idea of using incentives rather than coercion. So is the European Union self-engrossed? Perhaps. Is it Eurocentric? Perhaps. Is it actually doing quite a lot of interesting things on the world stage? Yes, it's causing controversy by doing it. Has it got enough visionaries? I don't think so, actually. actually. I think it needs to have its own festival of European ideas in order to work that out. And no doubt the University of Melbourne yet again has set an international trend. So I look forward to your questions. Thank you.
Philo, thank you very much. That was wonderful. Our third presenter is Mr. Leslie Rowe. Leslie is the Vice President of the Australian Institute for International Affairs and a long-serving and highly experienced former member of the Australian Diplomatic Corps. He was Australian Ambassador to the Russian Federation between 2002 and 2005 before retiring from the Foreign Service. And before that, had an extraordinary range of postings from Accra to Lisbon and Beirut to New York, Noumea and Jakarta. Leslie, we're looking forward to your perspectives on European Union ideas and Russia.
Thanks very much, Peter. Well, we never did find out whether Philomena spits out of train windows, but I guess we can work that one out later. When I was asked in September last year to speak on the effect of a resurgent Russia on the West, it seemed an absolutely cut and dried issue. After all, Russia was clearly resurgent. It had been undergoing 8 years of sustained economic growth after having been brought to its economic knees at the end of the 1990s. Over this period, the rapid rise in the oil and gas prices had enabled President Putin to position himself as the head of a resurgent Russia, more assertive and possessing the confidence and the financial resources to back this up. 9 months on, and the global financial crisis has further devastated key economies, including belatedly Russia, and thrown question marks about the relativities of world power and the future capacities of Russia, Europe and the US and other major players. Added to that, we have a new United States administration and a prospect of better relations between Russia and the United States. When people talk about a resurgent Russia, they frequently do so in the sense that, oh God, the bear's back. We're going to have the Cold War regenerated. I don't think that's in any way an adequate or true categorization of the notion of resurgence. The Russians have no stomach for an ideological confrontation with the West. Indeed, they probably don't have much of an ideology to confront with. They certainly wouldn't want to get into a contest which they know that they couldn't win. Before I get down to a more intense discussion of Russian foreign policy, I'd like to just turn a little bit to geography and it's instructive to have a look at maps of Russia. We all know where Russia is. We all think we know quite a bit about it, but it's only when you actually are confronted with the reality of it that you see something of its vastness. It occupies a seventh of the world's landmass, 17 million square kilometres. It's got the longest land borders in the world, and of course, with land borders, you have the responsibility to defend them, so it has one of the largest standing armies in the world. The Soviet Union, and before it, the Tsarist Empire, provided a secure land buffer around most of the Russian or Slavic heartland, and the dissolution of the Soviet Union removed that buffer so that all these countries on the periphery here were parts of both the Russian Empire and subsequently the Soviet Union. So Russia in 1991 became smaller than it had ever been at any time since the reign of Catherine the Great in the 18th century. The Russian Federation has land borders with 14 countries, North Korea, China, Mongolia, Kazakhstan, Azerbaijan, Georgia, Ukraine, Belarus, Latvia, Estonia, Finland, Norway. And through the enclave of Kaliningrad, just here, It has land borders with Poland and Lithuania and is completely encircled at that point by the European Union. It also, of course, has maritime borders with Japan and the United States. Five EU member states share land borders with Russia. That is Poland, Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, and Poland, and Finland. Of its neighbors, Georgia and Ukraine are aspirants to join the European Union. Russia itself, of course, is not likely ever, I would think, to become a member of the European Union. It's just too big and too difficult and too different. Estonia, Latvia, Poland, and Lithuania, all former Warsaw Pact members and current NATO members, have land borders with Russia, as do Ukraine and Georgia, both of whom aspire to membership of NATO. Russia's population is falling from 149 million in 1991 to 142 million, an estimate of 142 million this year, and some of the more dire projections have the population falling as low as 77 to 103 million, somewhere in that range, by 2053. That sort of decline has an enormous potential for strategic and economic development of Russia in the longer term, particularly when you see the weight of some of its neighbours, China particularly. 80% of the population lives west of the Urals, which are sort of roughly there, leaving this whole region here with only about 25 million people. And for many Russian defence planners and security planners, that's, of course, a constant nightmare. And in terms of Russia's capacity to maintain its sovereignty in the long haul over the eastern part of the country. Russia is divided into 73 administrative units, and if you think that we have problems running a federation in Australia, try doing it with 73 states. These all enjoy varying degrees of autonomy and they're different in size, resources, and ethnicity. And one of the tenets of the Russian Federation since its inception has been the maintenance of the unity of Russia. And to that end, Boris Yeltsin gave a great deal of autonomy to the regions, which was subsequently hauled back by Putin when it all got too unmanageable. But he famously said to the president of Tatarstan at the time, there's no point in being independent, just take as much independence as you can swallow. The Chechens were given the same advice, didn't take it, and have paid a terrible price in two punishing wars since. But this notion of national integrity is something that's absolutely central to the way Russians behave. Russia, of course, is a major supplier of gas and oil and minerals. It's got the largest reserves of natural gas in the world, second largest coal reserves, third largest known recoverable uranium reserves, and it goes on. Of course, it's also one of the world's... it is also the world's largest gas exporter, and 30% of that goes to countries of the European Union, and that's an issue which we'll come to later on, Europe's potential vulnerability to a cutting off of the gas pipelines, because almost all of the natural gas exported from Russia goes through a series of pipelines which are under state control. In addition to these elements of geography, it has the terrible legacy of the Soviet yoke and Soviet mismanagement hanging over its head, and it has to deal with the consequences of the privatization and other processes of the 1990s. It's important to remember that Russia has no tradition of democratic government or of a capitalist system. There was nobody living in Russia in 1991 who'd been a participant in a capitalist economies of pre-revolutionary Russia. So there was nobody there, as there were in parts of Eastern Europe and in China, to suddenly explain and work on the development of a capitalist system from experience. Also, Russia has a different intellectual and historical tradition from most of the countries of Western Europe. It's orthodox. Its Judeo-Christian heritage was different to the development of that heritage in other parts of Western Europe. It didn't connect with the West through the upheavals of the Renaissance and the Enlightenment. In 1812, 90% of the Russians were slaves, and Russia has a long history of repressive and autocratic regimes. The idea of the sovereignty of the people never took root in Russia and has still not really done so. To assist in the search for answers about how Russia might behave in the future, you'll indulge me, Peter, but as a former student of history, let me go back and trace the evolution of Russia and its foreign policy since 1991. Its relations with Western countries have had their ups and downs over this period, but there have been no contests over ideology. You'll recall that the whole Cold War confrontation was about ideology. Well, there's been no such contest over ideology. The Russians, by and large, accept the notion of a capitalist state. They accept a notion of democracy, although it's not a notion of democracy that's necessarily accepted elsewhere, and particularly not by many of its neighbours. In becoming the first head of an independent Russia in 1991, Boris Yeltsin worked to preserve the unity of the Russian Federation, dismantle the communist system by widespread privatization, create a capitalist system, and put in place new arrangements which would ensure that communism could not be reinstated. Now, that process ultimately led to the transformation of the society, but it resulted in enormous hardship for the majority of Russians, while privatization brought great, vast rewards to a few. The financial crisis of 1998 led to the destruction of the savings of many Russians who'd already suffered significant falls in their welfare and standards of living with the collapse of the Soviet Union. It was also instrumental in Yeltsin's decision to hand over the reins of power to Prime Minister, later President Putin. And the privatization processes, the introduction of democracy as it was seen at the time in the 90s, made many Russians extremely skeptical of democracy. In foreign policy, Yeltsin set aside the confrontationist policies of the Cold War, sort of more accommodating relations with the West. He undertook a program of nuclear collaboration with cooperation with the United States, which resulted in a reduction of significant numbers of Russian nuclear assets and the cleaning up of nuclear sites around the country, and he welcomed foreign investment. Over time, however, disillusion set in, and the notion of multipolarity began to come into the discourse of Russian policy thinkers. That is, the notion that without two superpowers, you can't have one superpower. So that international power must be spread amongst a number of different actors, and this was put very much by, initially by the Prime Minister of the day, Yevgeny Primakov. And it's a theme that has been picked up subsequently by both President Putin and President Medvedev in a reaction against the increasing power of the United States. Putin's early contacts with Western Europe and the West were pretty harmonious. I mean, he got on very well indeed with a number of the key European leaders, with Schroeder, because he'd served in Germany and he spoke German. They had a particularly close relationship, with Blair, with Chirac, with Berlusconi. And Bush, when Bush met him, he is reported of saying after his meeting, "I had a good talk with Vladimir. I looked into his eyes and reached into his soul." How you, it was quite a journey. He also, in what was, I think, both a masterstroke, he was the first Western leader to get on the telephone to Bush after 9/11. And he said to the Americans, "You can have, you know, do what you want to, do what you have to, you know, we'll make no problem for you." And that alone carried him through some of the early years of his presidency on a wave of goodwill. But and that was not without without its benefits for Russia, because the Russians had been telling Western countries a long time about the problems of Al-Qaeda training camps in the Caucasus, in Chechnya and Dagestan and close to the border with Georgia. And what Putin was looking for, I guess, was understanding of the Russians' own contest with an increasingly Islamic fundamentalist opposition to it in parts of the Caucasus. Over time, however, it became clear to the Russians that their expectations of the relationship with America were not in any way matched, or rather, their expectations of how the conduct of the relationship with America should be conducted was not in any sense matched by America's expectations. For Russia, America was an important equal partner. For the Americans, Russia was just another country which was making a mess of democracy and not doing a particularly good job of economic development. As Putin consolidated his power, he began consolidating in power in the latter years of his first term. He set the country towards a course of greater state control and authoritarianism, in which opposition to the government was muffled, politicians co-opted, and the parliament neutralized, in which human rights, press freedom, and civil society were increasingly marginalized, and key sectors of the economy brought back under state control. In the process, he forged a compact with the Russian electorate that they would accept the status quo in exchange for increasing prosperity, a compact which is coming under increasing strain as the effect of the global financial crisis hits. The fact that the middle class in Russia is small and largely confined to the major cities has been a significant impediment to the development of democracy, and the middle class is generally risk-averse and not a motive for progress. This having been said, while he was president, and I think still, he has enormous personal popularity in Russia. It's hard to tell always with opinion polls, but I think most observers would have the sense that the very high levels of support that he registers are genuine. In a foreign policy speech in Munich in 2007, he returned to this notion of charting Russia on a course of multipolarity, that it was necessary to move Russia away, that the improvement of relations that had taken place in the early days of his presidency was giving way, for a whole lot of reasons, to more contention between them, and he moved away from arguing for a close relationship with the United States and more to one in which international power was more shared around. Dmitry Trenin of the Moscow Carnegie Center, who's one of the best analysts, I think, on Russian strategic and foreign policy, categorized that policy at the time as being, as having three pillars. First, Russia's business is Russia. Second, Russia's business is business. And third, Russia's business is nobody else's business. So Russia wasn't there to get kicked around. Russia wasn't there to listen to lectures on how it should run its country and how it should it behave internally. And these themes have been pretty much picked up by Medvedev, who, in his own policy statement after the Georgian War in August 2008, reinforced them, but added to an element that, you know, Russia's interests in its immediate region ought to be acknowledged. He made clear that Russia would develop friendly relations with Europe, the United States, and other countries as much as possible, and committed himself to looking after the interests of Russian citizens wherever they may be. And that's a reference to the residual Russian communities that are left in some of the former states of the Soviet Union. There are many reasons why Russia and America, Russia and Europe had rubbed up against each other, and they were to do with different conceptions of society. Russia was concerned about inroads by NATO or by the European Union, by advocates of NATO in the countries of the former Soviet Union, neighbours of Russia. Russia is paranoid about NATO weapons being stationed close to its own borders. And this is one of the reasons why they're so antagonistic to the notion of further NATO expansion. They are particularly concerned about any incursion into Ukraine, which would result in the denial to Russia of its Black Sea Fleet premises in Sevastopol in Ukraine. But they also believe that they have particular interests in Ukraine, not least because of the very large Russian community remaining there, and feel that these have to be taken into account in any decisions taken in relation, long term, in relation to Ukraine. They have the same view about Georgia. They don't want weapon systems based in Georgia, close to the Russian heartland. Russia, from the European side, as I said, the things that concern Russia often have their obverse in relation to the European view of what Russia is up to. Nonetheless, Russia has collaborative relations both with EU countries and with the European Union as an institution, and it has an on-again, off-again relationship with NATO. As far as the United States is concerned, relations with the Bush administration soured badly, not least because of United States concerns about human rights, but also about the war in Iraq, which the Russians opposed from the outset. The early contacts between the Obama administration and the Russian government suggest that both sides are keen to seize the opportunity to improve relations, and President Obama is to visit Russia in July, and there have already been some indications that that they will continue the process of reduction of nuclear arms in the period for the remainder of this year up until the period when the START treaty has to be renegotiated in December. What then can we expect from Russia from now on? I think it's true that it's going to place a good deal of effort into building up its relations with countries of Central Asia. They are countries which, first of all, they are countries of their immediate neighbourhood. B, they're countries sitting on one of the largest untapped, unproven oil and gas reserves in the world. They will continue to work multilaterally through the Security Council. They've always put a great deal of store on the Security Council and the veto that they have within the Security Council and their capacity to influence its deliberations. Effect the global financial crisis will have on Russia and indeed on its partner countries is difficult to say. They've already suffered began to suffer badly, but as a major oil and gas exporter, their prospects of picking up income as the world economy picks up are greater than most. So it's quite likely that Russia will come out of it with some damage, but with the prospect of getting their resources back into some decent shape. At the end of the day, Russia can be expected to pursue its interests vigorously and at times will resort to threats and bullying. But I don't think it'll do so in a way which undermines its key interests, including its economic relations with the US and Western Europe. And the exception to that would be if either Georgia or Ukraine were to join NATO, or if Ukraine were to deny access to Russia for its ports. If Ukraine were to deny Russia access to its Black Sea port at Sevastopol. In the longer term, issues such as its claim on polar resources could become a point of friction. With Europe, however, it's unlikely to see the Russians willfully turning off the taps unless something very, very seriously were to occur, and I think we'd all get plenty of warning before that were to happen. Thank you.
Liz, thank you very much. Before I open it up to your questions and comments, one question I was going to put to the panel concerned the area in Eastern Europe that Liz referred to as the former buffer states of the Soviet Empire. And after all, in terms of the embedding of the idea of Europe in the 27 member states, some of those states seem, I guess, the most vulnerable from that point of view. I mean, it's there in Estonia and Lithuania where the participation rates in the European elections were as low as 20%. There where the prime ministers of both the Czech Republic and Hungary recently complained about a two-tier European Union, that they had been the countries with the highest growth rates, and yet they felt that they were regarded as second-class Europeans by the old countries of the European Union. And I just wonder whether, in fact, that part of Eastern Europe is an area that you would see as where the idea of Europe is still yet to be won, or is it a work in progress, or what would you say about that, David?
Well, the first thing I would say is I think that it is work in progress, as everything in the European project, if you like, is. I would also make the point that for a country joining the European Union, it's not like going into a dark room and you flick on a switch and suddenly everything is bright and wonderful and you see everything very clearly. It's much more a process, and it's a process much more like you're on a hill watching the dawn approach, and you see that it comes gradually, and you see that as time goes on, everything gets clearer and brighter. That's something important, I think, also to bear in mind, because the EU is not an instant magic solution for any member state. And I think you see the aspects of that probably more clearly when you're talking about acceding countries or newly acceded member states.
Phila, would you comment on that?
There is a concern about a new type of Iron Curtain falling over Europe, and there is a sense of dissatisfaction among many countries in Eastern Central Europe, not necessarily with the European Union, but really with the way that they're, you know, they've had to deal with the global financial crisis. But there is also a sense of a lack of ease with what is happening in terms of the relationship between the West and the East, as it were, in the sense that there is a that many of the prime ministers and leaders of Eastern Central European countries have said, we don't feel that we're understood. We feel that when in the West there were problems with inflation and recession in the 70s, in the 80s, the so-called Eurosclerosis, there was more assistance, and there's a considerable amount of anxiety and concern, and even stronger terms than that, stronger emotions than that, at the March European Council, which is the meeting of heads of government and states of the European Union, when they said, we actually want to have a better recovery package, and this was rejected, and that came from several of the Central and Eastern European countries. A recent report that came out from the European Union just a few weeks ago points out many of the problems that still remain, and actually, I think, is one of the most readable, most accessible reports ever produced in the European Union. It's absolutely fantastic, and it's called, I think, enlargement 5 years later. It's really, really good in talking about the challenges in dealing with the problems of adapting to the European Union way of behaving, its norms, its processes, but and also the sense of alienation that many of the countries still feel in Eastern and Central Europe.
I'm particularly interested in this from the perspective of climate change and environmental sustainability and so on, because after all, Australia is used to looking to Europe for all sorts of examples of good practice. Certainly, Europeans' footprint treads rather lighter than ours do on the planet here in Australia. And yet, we're talking there about countries in Eastern Europe, which is part of the former Soviet bloc, had very few restrictions on pollution and emitters and so on. And I guess one of the concerns that people have about the possible retreat into national self-interest at a time of economic stress is that there will not be the same pressure to accept European norms in terms of controls on pollution and so on as you would find in other parts of Europe. And Les, you'd be very well aware of just what the situation was and is in some cases in Russia in terms of pollution.
Well, I think in terms of Russia, if you want to write some good environmental guidelines, that they've got tomes of them. The problem is that they don't get round to taking much notice of them. And a pollution is an issue, a serious issue in many parts of Russia. On the other hand, they have the enormous birch forests that stretch right across the Russian landmass. Are a major source of carbon sink, and it's something to which the Russians feel that they ought to get credit in any trading schemes. But, of course, Russia is also a major producer of oil and gas. Oil and gas are major carbon emitters. As long as people buy Russian oil and gas, of course, that's going to be a contributing factor to global warming as well. But pollution is an issue, a serious issue in some particular parts of Russia, certainly.
I must say that I found the discussion around the participation rates in the most recent elections fascinating, because they sort of resonate with a lot of the sort of ordinary Europeans, particularly French people who I know, who would absolutely agree that the most wonderful thing about Europe is that they've come to terms with the fact that there is no that there hasn't been war for half a century, for almost their lifetimes. They accept happily, positively, the idea of Europe in all sorts of ways, and yet often there is a curious lack of affection. And I can well understand that at a time when people are very concerned about rapidly rising unemployment rates and so on in their own backyards, why they might feel, well, is voting in the European elections going to do anything? That sort of makes sense from that point of view. And of course, as you were saying, David, it's actually a very short space of time in which people have been trying to make the idea a reality in terms of a new identity that people can accept as well as their own particular local one. Mm-hmm. Philo, do you want to comment? comment?
The term multiple identities is used a lot of the time, and I think that that's not a bad one. It's actually quite easy to feel Catalan and European and not terribly Spanish, for instance. And in a sense, there's a sense of being able to choose to what extent you are European. I don't actually think it matters if people don't feel European or don't have an affection for the European Union. If you saw the buildings, they don't inspire love. You know, we're not looking at the, you know, it's true. I mean, just, you know, and the fact that, you know, when I was a trainee in one of them, I remember years ago, I didn't know that we had asbestos in the building then. And, you know, it just sort of, they're not pretty buildings, but they do, this. I don't think the European Union needs to actually replicate the flags and the anthems of the nation state. I think what matters is when you actually have, for instance, on the uniforms of the peacekeepers, of the people involved in conflict transformation, that people are actually putting themselves in danger in military or civilian or both operations, and the involvement of police and army, for instance, and judges or whoever. When you find in the army, in the armies and in the police, that they actually wear the European flag on their arm, I think that is where the symbolism is important. It doesn't really matter how many people love, don't love, or feel a bit antipathetic about the European Union. I think it's a pity about the European Parliament, partly because it seems to be this huge monolith, partly because people don't understand it, and partly because there have been a lot of scandals about people using their allowances in a way that they shouldn't by sleeping on the couch in their office in Brussels, sometimes with somebody they weren't actually legally married to. And so a lot of these scandals have undermined what I think is a very valuable institution, but unfortunately it gets extremely bad press and it makes its own very bad press sometimes as well. So I don't think you need, I think multiple identities is a nice flexible way of looking at it, and I'm not actually too worried about the turnout. It's gone down from 62 to 43 over 30 years. That's right. And I think that it's more important actually when you see the Eurobarometer, the opinion polls of the European Union, about the European Union, which say, if you had a choice, which of the following should be trying to bring about a better world, or sometimes more specific, you know, solving the problems in Rwanda or whatever it might have been. And you will see that consistently, they all say the European Union, rather than their nation state or NATO or the United Nations. I think that sort of thing is more important than whether, you know, I look at the buildings and I feel so European, I can just cry. You know, I don't think that matters.
Peter, I'd like to come back on a couple of these points. The first is that I realise I only answered half of the first question. I feel I ought to go back to the second half. The question of a new Iron Curtain or feeling sort of shortchanged by new member states. I think there is an element of the form of something rather than the substance. Some of the new member states were looking for a specific sort of Eastern Europe balance of payments fund. And instead of that, what they got and what we all got was a quadrupling of the balance of payments fund ceiling up to 50 billion euro from, it had been 12, I think, last December, and it has been increased twice since then. But there's an important reason why that was done, and that was to precisely not create a new barrier, not to have a new fund for Eastern Europe, if you like, where then you are creating a barrier. There is a fund in Europe, and we're all in it together. And East European member states will benefit from it as anybody else will benefit it. So I think that in substance, I think they got a lot of what was needed, and in the form, no. The other point is that nobody ever gets everything that they want. That's the way the union functions. So in every summit, you have people who come out with various degrees of smiles afterwards, or frowns, but nobody's entirely happy, and nobody is really entirely unhappy. The other point on the climate change, here I'll just make two points. The first is that the European Union, when it takes on obligations, these are obligations of the Union. And the Union will meet these obligations, whether it's Kyoto, whether it's whatever is agreed in Copenhagen. And the process of meeting these obligations is obviously one which is extremely complicated and quite difficult inside the Union. And there is an element, a large element, of what we call burden sharing So the costs and benefits, I mean, there's these things have to be haggled over. But solutions are found, and I think that's the key thing to remember. And as part of that process, the weaknesses of particular member states and the strengths of others, all of these factors go into the pot. The third point I'd like to make is to, well, while I don't share Philo's unsentimental attachment to the beautiful buildings in Brussels, nonetheless, I think it is very important, the question of seeing the European flag on a soldier's badge. This is something that an Irishman, a British guy, a Portuguese, a Greek, we can all look at that and say, that guy is there because we have put him there, and he's there doing a job for us. And that is something very powerful. The question of multiple identities is something which I think the Union has made it easier for people to accept. I don't feel any less Irish because I also feel European, and I wouldn't expect French to feel less French or British to feel less British. Why should they?
Well, in many cases, it's been a triple identity, hasn't it, in terms of feeling Catalan as well as French or Spanish and European. We've got time just for a few very quick questions. Yes.
Well, we could do a seminar on this question, of course. I think the key thing to remember is that if you take a photograph of Turkey as it is today, and you take a photograph of Turkey on the eve before it joins the European Union, those two photographs would be quite contrasting. And the contrast between those two photographs would just tell you the sort of journey that Turkey still needs to make. There are major issues, human rights, various freedoms, various elements of tolerance and so on. This is a journey that Turkey must make. Now, there are also issues on the EU side of the table as well, which have to get hammered out. But it is Turkey is a project which has probably a long way to go. But Turkish membership of the European Union is something which we in the European Commission see as a very big prize, and Turkey has a tremendous potential to play a very important role in the world and as a member of the European Union.
We've got time for just one last question that's here in front. Just wait for the microphone, if you would.
The UK.
Could you just wait for the microphone, please? Yes, here.
Emeritus Professor Grichting. The UK, Switzerland and Denmark have kept their own currency. How do we read that? As a lack of commitment to EU? Would you please comment? Thank you.
Philo, I think you should have a go at that.
Yep. I don't think it's a lack of commitment to the EU. The Swiss are never going to adopt it because they're not in the EU. The UK, it really is very much a symbol of sovereignty in a way that really it isn't as much, it hasn't been for other countries. But giving up your currency is a sacrifice. It certainly has been. And maybe the Germans were less sentimental about it, but it was the linchpin of economic recovery in Western Europe for so long. So all of them had a reason to feel it was important. Gradually, we are seeing, and now there are 16 members, Slovenia and Slovakia, the two most recent, for example, to have joined from the former Central Eastern Europe. And bit by bit, there is an incentive to join it. I don't think it makes them more or less European. It makes it tremendously easy to ensure parity of prices, to ensure ease of movement on all of those other issues. But I wouldn't see it as the linchpin or the cornerstone of a test for whether one is European or not.
Philo, thank you. And I'm sorry that we will have to bring this to a close. There are lots of questions I still have and lots of questions I'm sure are still in the audience. But that was a fascinating panel session. Thank you all very much. David, you're dying to have one last word.
Just one last word.
Two last words.
One last word.
I do think, Philo, you should talk to other people when you go to Brussels. And certainly, we in the European Commission in Canberra, we do not have this arrogant approach that you get with others.
So. All right. Last word to David. And could you join me in thanking our panelists?